Charlie or Phil?
Charlie.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Randall C. Eads, and I represent Mr. Brad Roop, the appellant in this matter. Before I begin to argue the legal side of this, I want to remind the court of the facts of this case. Not only do the facts of this case pertain to Mr. Roop, but it could pertain to any sheriff's deputy in the Commonwealth of Virginia at any time. Mr. Roop was captain of the Criminal Investigation Division for the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office. He received a call from the Department of Forensic Science that says, "We have approximately 29 controlled substance buys from your office, where many of those buys have returned no controlled substances." That alerted Mr. Roop that something was going wrong, whether it was going wrong with the Street Crimes Unit of the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, or whether it was something going wrong with the Department of Forensic Science, or whether it was going wrong with the confidential informants that the Street Crimes Unit was using. He advised the Sheriff Witt that he was going to look into the matter. Sheriff Witt said, "Please look into the matter and report back to me." And that is exactly what Captain Roop did. He reported his findings to the Sheriff. The Sheriff then placed him on paid administrative leave for a period of approximately 7 weeks. And then he was terminated. A complaint was filed in December of 2012. And my complaint states the facts succinctly and as the Rule 1.4D requires. Let's not lose sight of the fact that the only thing a plaintiff has to do is cite the facts of a case. A plaintiff does not have to cite their legal theory. It does not need to even cite the statute for which they rely upon in the complaint. The rules plainly requires that the facts be succinctly cited, which were in this case. Defendants filed a motion or demurrer, and at that hearing, no evidence was considered by the court, only argument of counsel. During the argument and after the court ruled that Mr. Roop was not a local employee, and he made that ruling without any evidence as to whether or not Mr. Roop was a local employee, no evidence was taken in this matter. He made that ruling, said he is not a local employee, and therefore a cause of action does not exist. And not only that, the court even said that a sheriff has unfettered discretion in the hiring and firing of deputies. And that is not true. And that is not true because there is a statute that says when a local employee brings acts of malfeasance, fraud, or other incidences of abuse to an elected official, the employee shall not be retaliated against. And that's where things kind of get murky in the procedure of this case. The court ruled that Mr. Roop is not a local employee. In my opinion, the court plainly ignored the facts of the case. And a demurrer is only contests the sufficiency of the facts and not the law. And the facts must be accepted as true. And the complaint states that Mr. Roop was an employee. And that he was a local employee. And the court ignored that fact. So now we have to argue to this court whether or not Mr. Roop is a local employee. And the only way that we can look at that is by what the General Assembly has said and what this court has stated a local employee is. First, the General Assembly, in Title 15.1-1512.2, defines a locality as a city, town, or a county. Secondly, it defines a law enforcement officer as a deputy of a sheriff's department. It does not define a local employee. Now, the appellee in this case states that those definitions are for that section only. And I concede that fact because it does state for this section only. However, it is also under the same chapter as the statute upon which we rely in regards to the retaliation claim. And if you look at that, if you take the definitions of what a locality is and what a law enforcement officer is, I think the logical conclusion would be that a deputy would be considered a local employee. Now,
counsel, that might be logical, but the statute specifically says for the purposes of this section, if you were to leaf through the Code of Virginia, you would find that typically definitions come as the very first section of a chapter or of an article. It is rare for the General Assembly to have a list of provisions and say, this is just for this section. So how can we ignore that, in particular in light of 15.2, I think 1603, that says sheriffs can hire and fire their deputies?
Well, just as I told Justice Lacey when I was arguing for the writ, you have two competing statutes. You have one statute that says an employee cannot be retaliated against. And then you have the 1603 that says a sheriff can do whatever he pleases. And those are two competing statutes for which, when you have two competing statutes, there has to be some form of discovery to determine which statute would apply.
And why do you need discovery unless you need facts?
Because there was no evidence taken at the demurrer hearing in regards to what a local employee was. And
well, doesn't the complaint, Mr. Reed, say that he was a deputy and he rose through the ranks to become a captain?
That's correct. He is an employee of the sheriff.
What facts do you think might be relevant to the determination of what statute is applicable?
Well, I think the fact that Mr. Root was notified that there was some issue going on with the drugs that were being sent to the Department of Forensic Science. And now you have to look at what was causing that problem. And if there was evidence of fraud, abuse, gross mismanagement, things of that nature, and which we have cited in our complaint, then the statute of 1512.4 would apply. But then again, we still have the question of whether or not a deputy is a local employee. The appellee wants this court to believe that a deputy is not a local employee. The cases that the appellee has cited in this case were all pre-Bowman, and I'll get to the Bowman issue in just a moment, but they were all, the cases that are cited are all pre-Bowman, with the exception of one case, which was in dealing with a Commonwealth attorney and a FOIA request. The cases that were cited did not address the fact of what a local employee was. It only addressed the fact that a constitutional officer is not bound by certain liability requirements. One was a 1983 action. There were some other actions in regards to what. One was even a garnishment, whether or not a sheriff's salary could be garnished. None of those cases describe what a local employee is and whether or not a deputy is a local employee. And for that fact, not one case from this court has ever said whether or not a deputy is a local employee or not, which needs to be cleared up. Whether it be with this case or another case, at some point this matter will rise again. In regards to Bowman, the appellee wants this court to believe that I should have cited Bowman in my complaint, that it's a Bowman complaint, that it should have been argued in the complaint. And that's not the case. Bowman set aside a narrow exception to the employment at will policy. And that is the exception that we're going on. It is a violation of public policy. And by firing Captain Root for what we believe was retaliation for bringing matters of possible mismanagement of the street crimes unit to his attention. And Bowman states, or Miller states, Miller v. CVAMP, an exception to the employment at will doctrine limited to discharges which violate public policy, that is, the policy underlying existing laws designed to protect the property rights, personal freedoms, health, safety, or welfare of the people in general. And that's exactly what Captain Roof was doing with the sheriff. He was alerting the sheriff that there is a problem. We're here to protect the people in general. We're here to protect the health, the safety, and the welfare of the people of Montgomery County. And once he alerted the sheriff of that fact, within 4 days after alerting the sheriff of that fact, he is put on a paid administrative leave. and then he's fired. And that is a violation of public policy when an employee is bringing something to the forefront of his employer, saying, we have a problem, it needs to be solved. And the employer overlooks that fact and says, you're going to be quiet, and you're going to get fired because you brought this to my attention. Your Honor, I would take the remaining 4 minutes and 40-some-odd seconds for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Dillon, and I'm appearing on behalf of Sheriff Witt in this case. With regard to Section 15.2-1512.4, it refers to local employees. The General Assembly has shown that it knows how to include appointees and employees of constitutional officers when it desires to include appointees and employees of constitutional officers. It has shown that in 15.2-1512.2, right in this same section, and it has shown that with regard to benefits cited by Mr. Roop's counsel in the brief, with regard to federal Social Security benefits, when it talks about local employees and it speaks of constitutional officers and their appointees' employees as special employees, not, and specifically included them in the definition. Because they recognize that constitutional officers in Virginia are special. They are constitutional officers. And the courts have said over and over again that constitutional officers are not employees, and their appointees and employees of constitutional officers are not employees of a locality. They have made that distinction. They showed the same analysis applied in the Canal case with regard to FOIA and Commonwealth attorneys. The court noted that also in that act, when the General Assembly wanted to include a Commonwealth attorney in the requirements of that act, it specifically noted that Commonwealth attorneys were included. So Commonwealth attorneys were not included in the more general public bodies of that act. And the same analysis applies with regard to 15.2-1512.4. With regard to the Bowman claim, suppose, in this case, plaintiff didn't include the Bowman claim in the pleading. There was one count of retaliation. Initially, we got to one count of retaliation after the federal claim was removed. Bowman was not mentioned in the complaint, was never mentioned before the trial court, ever, and was only mentioned for the very first time in this brief. It wasn't mentioned in the petition. Under 5:25, it is improper to now bring this Bowman theory of wrongful discharge to this court. The trial court had no opportunity to consider that legal theory at all. So that claim is improperly before this court. And plaintiff has waived, which was argued below, waived a cause of action directly under 15.2, 15.4, and asserted below at the trial court level a possible cause of action under 8.01-221, and that's been waived.
I take it you're agreeing that it's not necessary to mention the Bowman case in the pleadings, but that it's absolutely necessary to argue the theory of the Bowman case in the demur, or else you have waived it. Is that your position?
It's my position that if plaintiff is relying on a Bowman theory that plaintiff has to at least mention that in argument against the demur, or at some point in time.
Well, it's not the magic word of the case. We have lots of cases that we decide here, and people have pleadings that don't refer to the legal theories by case names.
Correct.
And they're sufficient. So in the pleadings, it would seem to me that a retaliation claim arguably might be a Bowman claim.
It could be.
And so it's not necessary to say a claim under the Bowman case, so long as you read the pleadings and you have what could arguably be a Bowman claim. But when you get to a demur and you don't inform the court that this is a claim based on public policy of the Commonwealth, and that's why you should not sustain the demur, it seems to me that's where the problem is.
Yes, Your Honor. And especially when you articulate to the court the specific statutes you are relying upon for a cause of action, and you fail to mention a Bowman-type case at all. The trial court had no notice whatsoever that that's what we were looking at. We should look at the pleading to see if it's sufficient in that regard. There was no notice to the trial court in that with regard to that claim. I would also note to the court that there's an assignment of error with regard to the denial of the leave to amend the complaint. And as plaintiff points out, good cause exists to amend a complaint if there's been no previous amendment, a timely request was made, and there's no suggestion of prejudice to the other party. In this case, we had the initial complaint, and we had two amended complaints. We had two requests for leave to amend. One was granted at the state court level, and the complaint was amended. And then the second request after the initial complaint. Let me get this straight. There were three motions for leave to amend. One in federal court in January of 2013, the second on May 30th in 2013 in state court, and then finally on the hearing date, February 24th, 2014. That is the motion that was verbally made to the court and was denied. And that is the one in question before this court. This was over a year after the complaint. It was not timely made. It was made during the hearing when it appeared that the plaintiff would not prevail. And furthermore, plaintiff admits in the brief that he was not going to include any new facts in that pleading, and that it was not necessary for him to include a Bowman theory in that pleading, so an amendment would not even be necessary according to plaintiff. So we would assert that there can be no error with regard to that assignment. And we would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Reed, you have 4 minutes and 44 seconds left.
Thank you.
You might start by addressing the question that I addressed with her. What is the problem with the demur stage? I think you might very well be over the pleading stage, but you have to put a trial judge on notice of the nature of your claim, and if you don't describe it sufficiently enough, at least to invoke the principle, maybe not the case by name, but the principle, how have you put the trial court on notice?
Your Honor, I'm going to respectfully disagree with Ms. Dillon. I distinctly remember when myself and the trial, and the other issue is here, there are no transcripts of that hearing. This hearing, the only thing the court has before it are the orders and the complaints that have been filed. But at that hearing...
That was going to be my second question. Frankly, it's the appellant's responsibility to have a record that allows us to determine that. But go ahead and make your argument, and then tell me how we're going to review it.
I distinctly remember the trial court and I discussing the matter, and I said that this is a violation of public policy. The amended complaint that was made orally at the hearing last year, last March, and that was made after the court had already made the decision to sustain the defendant's demur. It's like being tied down to a railroad track, and you can't move. You see the train coming, but there's nothing you can do about it. And the only thing that I could do at that point is to potentially make a motion to amend for something, and it's correct. I wasn't going to amend. There was no new facts to allege whatsoever. The only words that I could have added to the complaint would have been it was a violation of public policy, which is not necessarily a fact, but more of a legal theory. And there were no facts that could be added to the complaint. And the appellee cites the White v. Fields case. So it says, since the sheriff is liable absolutely for all the acts of the deputy, the sheriff should have complete and unfettered control over who his deputies are, and their oneness would include unilateral political beliefs. This case does not state that it should, that the deputy should have unilateral beliefs when it comes to personnel management. And this is what we have. It's a personnel management issue, not a political belief between Mr. Roop and the sheriff. Secondly, that same case states that a sheriff and a deputy are one person. And one, if that's the case, then a sheriff could never be sued for any reason whatsoever by his deputy, because one cannot sue himself, which does not make sense when you're seeking justice for wrongdoing. And I'm going to address the court's concern on how to review it. The court has to look at this case de novo. You look at the complaint, and the complaint has facts that are sufficient to alert the defendant and the trial court that, one, it was a retaliation, and two, that based upon the facts that were presented, it was a violation of public policy. The facts are extremely clear. There was 84-some-odd paragraphs in regards to that complaint. And it expressly explained to the defendant and to the court what the problem was. And the problem was the sheriff retaliated against Captain Roop for bringing something to his attention that he did not like. And the only thing that this court can look at is the record that it's before today. You can look at the complaint, you can look at the demur, and you can look at the handwritten order that the court suggested we make that day, which was later amended March 13th, I believe, of 2013.
But and that's one thing, counsel, one thing I guess you're saying we can't look at is the oral amended complaint.
Well, and honestly, that's incidental. As I said before, the train had already come, it had run over me, and I'm trying to save the case at the very last stage. And whether or not that amendment was made or granted, I believe, is incidental as to whether or not the trial court reviewed the facts in the complaint and determined whether or not a sufficient cause of action was stated because of those facts. And I think that's where the trial court
erred. Let me ask you this question. If we agree, and I'm not saying we are, with the trial court that, in fact, the sheriff's deputy was not a local employee, isn't it important that we be able to see, which we can't, the oral amended complaint, which has a different reason?
Well, the complaint, since the court denied that, you know, I can't produce the complaint to this court now as to what it would have been.
Well, generally, though, when we consider issues of the trial court failing to grant a motion to amend, the motion to amend the amended complaint is part of the record, so we can see if there was an error or not.
Correct. But the court denied my ability to amend that complaint, so there was nothing for this court to review. I think what's important for this court to determine is whether or not the court was in error when it sustained the defendant's demurra, stating that there was no cause of action. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will take a brief recess.
All right. Thank you.